Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a documentary about a Vegas blackjack dealer with an incredible past in ballet. Then a potter is bringing awareness about arthritis and body positivity through their ceramics. And the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra has a big weekend of concerts. Today's show, we're closing out Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with great artists. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. Nearly 60 million people in the U.S. live with the country's number one cause of disability, arthritis. And there are over 100 types of arthritis. Now, all of that data I shared is from the Arthritis Foundation. May is Arthritis Awareness Month, and the Arthritis Foundation has reached out to artists to spread the word about the issue through their campaign called Green Heart Fridays. And that's where artists will drop some green heart-inspired art in their city. So spreading some arthritis love in San Francisco is Viviana Matsuda. They are a potter whose mugs went viral, and they own the very colorful store Emotion Potion. I'm so happy that they are here. Hey, Viviana.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. I'm glad you're here. You know, looking at your art, it just brought a smile to my face because It's so colorful and it makes me want to just get cozy. So your mug, the Chubby Cup, gave you a lot of media attention, and I understand it's inspired by body positivity. So can you give us the story of the Chubby Cup and where that all came from?
Yeah, so when I was learning pottery, I kind of learned by accident. My dad was a potter, and when he passed away, I inherited a bunch of his like supplies. So I took a pottery class to kind of work through the grief and also work through some of his supplies. And at the same time, while I was learning pottery, I was diving headfirst into the body positivity movement on Instagram and seeing for the first time like chubby bodies and these like beautiful photo shoots that you just like didn't see before that. Mm-hmm. It was like really hard to come by, you know, growing up in the early 2000s was kind of a nightmare for anyone with a body. And so I think subconsciously in my mind, like my new appreciation for kind of the movement and everything combined with my new learning of ceramics turned into these like abstract body shapes, which was very chubby.
So how old were you when your dad passed?
I was 27, something like that.
Wow. So you got into this at 27. Did you ever make pottery with your dad?
Not really. I was always around pottery because he was a potter since he was 18. So he was consistently like taking classes and stuff. Even when he retired, like he was like taking sculpting, and I'd be like, can you pencil me in for like a lunch? Like he's so busy. But he was still like sculpting and doing all that stuff. But unfortunately, not really. But every once in a while, we'd like, you know, he would just tell me a project he's working on and I'd be interested, but not together.
Okay. Wow. So that's a beautiful story, you know, that you are, you know, took on something that he loved and it's turned into something that has brought joy to so many people. And also too, I was reading in an article where you said like basically ceramics can be therapeutic in a way for you.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Yeah, so I feel like there's not a lot of opportunities for us to like literally put our phone down, and there's something very like relaxing, therapeutic about doing pottery. I kind of feel like we've all done some form of like mud pies when we were children, and that was like, you know, when we're exploring and we're safe, and we don't allow ourselves as adults to do that, really, to get messy, to like kind of just have fun with mess. Mm-hmm. And I think a part of that, and then also just being super disconnected from like social media or your phone, period, is like, it's a good thing. You have to, you literally can't use it while your hands are all muddy. And I think it's just with all this stuff happening, you know, it's a good way to kind of work your, like, relax your brain.
Yeah, no, I could see that definitely. And that's the great thing about art as far as that being an alternative, like when you want a break from the screen, you know. So I'm not a potter, so I have coloring books. That's as far as I can go.
That's great. I mean, whatever works for you, I think that what it's great.
Yeah. And it helps me kind of like to zone out and like it calms my mind, you know, because when you're on your computer working and yeah, and all that. So I can see how it's funny. I know people mentioned Ghost, the movie Ghost, to you, that scene.
Yeah, there's a pottery studio in the East Bay that they has a sign that says no ghosting. It's actually kind of dangerous to have two people on a wheel at once, but I think it's very funny.
Oh, really?
Well, because like, yeah, like your hands can get stuck in the clay while it's going pretty fast, and you can hurt your fingers.
Okay, I never. It's funny because they romanticized that scene in the movie so much. I didn't know like that could have been dangerous.
Yeah.
Okay,
Well, I think it is, but I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
you're the pro, so I'll take your word on it. So also, so your heritage also inspires your work, and I understand you use Japanese and Mexican techniques when creating. What's unique about those techniques when creating ceramics?
I think it's more about like design. Like I feel like Japanese silhouettes can definitely be, or traditional Japanese silhouettes are very simple, but very thoughtful. And then my Mexican side is very colorful and vibrant. And I think that the combination of the two makes the pieces like a little, like I like to keep it kind of simple, but also kind of weird, if that
Okay.
makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, so they're like almost like my version of classics, because I won't ever get sick of them because they're a little funky, you know?
Well, and I think too, that's the appeal to your work as well. So I definitely get the vibe as far as yeah, like the color and just like you said, kind of the funkiness to it, and then the blending of culture. I totally get all of that when I look at your work.
Thank you.
Okay, so you're here. One of the reasons why you're here is to talk about Arthritis Awareness Month. Now, do you suffer from arthritis?
I don't, but I feel like it might be in my future. My partner's grandma suffers from arthritis really severely, and that's kind of why I wanted to do this with the Arthritis Foundation. It's kind of a sad story, but she's 90, and she made a baby blanket for my partner, and we don't have any babies. And she was like, "Well, this might be the last year I can actually like use my hands to do something handmade because my arthritis is so bad." And I was like, "That is really sad." As a person who crafts and loves to work with my hands, and she does as well, that's like pretty devastating.
Yeah, no, oh no, my heart goes out to her. You know, and I'm thinking about too, like you said, you use your hands a lot. I use my hands a lot when I type, so I have to be mindful of how I take care of my body. How do you take care of your body as someone who works with clay and does ceramics?
I try my best to get up and stretch and keep it moving. I walk a lot, which doesn't really help with the stretching. That helps with like circulation and everything. I walk like maybe 3 or 4 miles a day, mostly for my mental health, because I'm like need a sniff of flower to like get the mood up, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, but I think mental health is like, I mean, yeah, your body too, but like the both of them for sure.
Yeah, and May is also Mental Health Awareness Month. So
Oh, right. A lot of overlap.
it's a lot going on in May.
Yeah.
So you joined the Green Hearts Friday campaign. Has I mean, you know, you're talking about your partner's grandmother. Has this all made you think about like how you create art, especially when we're thinking about people like with disabilities?
100%. When I first got approached to do it, to make some pieces, I was like, okay, I thought about like what will make like what makes mugs or pottery like more accessible to people. And like I like Googled, you know, like what helps with making it accessible. And having two handles makes it really accessible, or having like a non-grip based like handle, almost like a wine glass where you can literally just like have it on the palm of your hand, but like with a stem in between. Like those types of things are really good for that. But I think the double handle, I was like, oh wow, I can really like kind of run with that. So that's for the pieces that I've contributed to this project. Most of them have been two handles.
Okay. For those just joining us, I'm chatting with Viviana Masuda. They are a ceramics artist and founder of the store Emotion Potion. I love that name. And we're here talking about art and Arthritis Awareness Month. Okay. So you're part of the Green Heart Friday campaign through the Arthritis Foundation. And there's artists around the country that are leaving art every Friday in the month of May, somewhere in their city. And where, first of all, where have you left art and what have you left?
So far I've left art at Glen Park, Dolores Park, Mission Playground, and Persida Park. But yeah, and they've if most of them have been either double handle mug, no handle mug that requires no grip to carry it, or a double handled vase.
Okay. So have you heard from people who found the your pieces?
Yeah, the first person posted about it, which I really appreciated, and they had arthritis, and so they were like, "Oh, it's just kind of like a nice, thing," which I really appreciate because when they post about it, it also brings awareness to the Arthritis Foundation.
So how can we, because this is fun, it's like a treasure hunt. So how do we know like where you're going to put your next piece and yeah.
So on this Friday, I'll be posting on my Instagram like hints of where it is. Usually I post the location of the park, but then parks are big, so I'm like, it's near this, the swings or something, or I'll like give a little hint. But yeah, my Instagram is mud.witch, so mudwitch. But I'll post where it is and then like a picture of it. So you'll be like, oh, I think it's near this bench because I can see that in the background. So yeah, it's a scavenger hunt. I think it's really a fun idea.
Yeah, it is a scavenger hunt. So have people found your pieces because they were on your social media?
So far, I don't really know. I mean, the initial first person posted about it, but I haven't gotten any feedback or anything from the last couple people, but I hope so.
Okay, so for people, if you want to find one of their pieces, Viviana's pieces, go on their Instagram. And what's the handle again?
It's mud.witch.
Okay, so go on the Instagram handle and then have you dropped cute? No, you're going to drop clues when on Friday?
Friday, yeah.
Okay, so go like maybe Friday morning on your Instagram, Viviana's Instagram, to see what clues they've dropped and maybe you can find one of their pieces. Which is, again, that sounds like a lot of fun. Okay, I want to, before I let you go, Viviana, I want to talk about Emotion Potion, which is an adorable name. I love it.
Thank
And
you.
I was looking at pictures of your store, Emotion Potion, and I was like, it feels like it's made from rainbows, joy, and inner child spirit. It's just like Viviana's store is so, it's like for people in the 80s, remember Lisa Frank? It's like Lisa, the colors is like Lisa Frank and Sanrio, Hello Kitty store. What is in Emotion Potion? Like, just talk about, what can people find there? Because you're not just doing pottery. I saw clothing in there.
Yeah, so we do we specialize in plus size clothing. We have straight sizes as well, but plus size workwear and vintage clothing, and we have also like a bunch of vintage housewares and weird little tchotchkes. The like whole thing is just to like bring joy to your day, bring joy to your house. I get a lot of people saying like, oh, this scratched an itch in my head that I didn't even know I needed. Because it's very satisfying to be there, whether you're buying stuff or not. It's just kind of a fun place to be.
Well, I'm gonna have to pop in one of these days because, yeah. And what made you, and I know you do body positivity, but what made you specifically want to hold or carry clothes for people that are plus size? And you said, and it's working clothes.
Yeah, because I needed them, to be honest. Like, every time I go to a vintage shop, I'm like, I'll get the hats and the shoes, and that's about it. And I'm like, where's all the stuff for everybody else? And I think that I just really wanted to provide what I wanted to see, which is like, I wear workwear pants. I'm work in a studio and whatnot, and I need sometimes like overalls or something, not the like ones that like are super hyper feminized, which if that's your thing, that's fine. But like, I just want pants. Like, I think that's like a very minimal ask, but sometimes shops feel like that's not, and so I wanted to provide that.
And so you hand make the pants, or like, are they pants that you
Oh
okay?
no.
Do you color them? Because they're bright colors.
Yeah, so we get them from a vintage wholesaler who professionally overdyes them so they don't bleed or anything like that.
Oh, that's good.
And they're real workwear, so they're gonna last a really long time.
Okay, nice. So like, yeah, so you can look fashionable while you're doing some of your like more blue collarish type of work. Yeah, or things. Okay, that's awesome. And where is your store located?
It's on Guerrero and 18th.
Okay, so for people who want to go check out Emotion Potion, yeah, go to Guerrero and
Awesome.
18th.
Yeah, it's
Viviana,
the Rainbow Building. You can't miss it.
I was about to say, I saw a picture. You can't miss it. I saw a picture and I was like, you cannot. I will definitely come in that store because, like I said, just looking at the pictures just lit me up. So, Viviana, thank you so much. I can't wait to meet you in the very near future because I definitely want to go to Emotion Potion.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, Viviana Matsuda owns the crafty, colorful store Emotion Potion in San Francisco, and you can visit arthritis.org for more information on their Green Heart Fridays campaign. Coming up, an incredible story about a ballet dancer who opened the path for other Asian American dancers to come onto the stage. That's all coming up next. Stay with us. Listening to the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. We're almost at the end of Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and I want to talk about someone who has an incredible story, George Lee. Mr. Lee was a Chinese American ballet dancer. The New York Times reported he died in April at the age of 90 in a Las Vegas hospice center. George Lee was a trailblazer for Asian American dancers. He performed in the original Nutcracker about 70 years ago. Gene Kelly cast him in Flower Drum Song. But many people didn't know Mr. Lee's history because he spent most of his life working as a blackjack dealer in downtown Las Vegas. In the documentary 10 Times Better, Mr. Lee tells the story of immigrating to the U.S. and making it to Broadway. Here's a clip of him talking about how his mother pushed him to greatness.
One thing my mother warned me, you are going to America, it's all white people. And you better be 10 times better. Remember that, 10 times better, because you cannot match to them. You gotta be 10 times better. And that stuck in my head. So I was do anything, I do the best I can, 10 times better than anybody else can do.
You can stream the documentary on PBS.org or YouTube. I'm so excited that people are going to have more access to watch this. Bay Area journalist John Futabiki is one of the film's producers. I spoke with him in 2024 about profiling Mr. George Lee. Keep in mind, this interview occurred before Mr. Lee passed away this April. John Futabiki, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here with you, Janae.
I am excited to talk to you because this is an incredible story. Mr. George Lee, just again, just an amazing story. How did the filmmakers find him?
We actually stumbled across this while we were working on and continue to work on another film called Beyond Yellow Face, which is about the history of Asian Americans in ballet. And Jennifer Lee, who's the director, was doing some research in the archives of the New York Public Library for the performing arts. And he discovered some photographs of and news articles and programs that mentioned this fantastic dancer named George Lee, Chinese American, who appeared in George Balanchine's first The Nutcracker. And she said to herself, "Who is this guy? I've never heard of him." And that was the beginning of this film.
That's amazing how she found him just digging around just in
Right.
the library. Wow. And the title 10 Times Better comes from something that a phrase or a saying that his mother told him is something that resonates with a lot of people of color. I know in the black community, we say something similar. I know, for immigrants, many immigrants that come here, that's told too. And I just thought that was just really powerful. And in the film, we could see him doing 10 times better. I mean, first of all, he's a prodigy, right?
Yes.
But, you know, he could jump higher than some of the other
dancers.
Yeah. They talked about how he could shape their body almost like a ball, and they couldn't do that.
Right.
Did he realize how good he was?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. I think he knew that he was good because this was hammered into him by his mother. Now, let's back up a little tiny bit. George Lee, born in Hong Kong, grew up in Shanghai. His father was a Chinese acrobat, and his mother was a Polish ballet dancer, a ballerina. And so from the youngest age, when he got up in the morning, his mother would train him in ballet moves. He would say, George, you need to do exactly what I do every day. And that's how he became a ballet dancer. And she was very strict, very, very, very strict in all ways, not only in his dance technique, but in his living. She forbid him to drink coffee. And he didn't have his first coffee until he became an adult and was away from his mom. And coffee is now his favorite drink. But his technique was just absolutely spot on. And he surprised people, but he would not brag about it. One of the interesting things about George Lee, as we came to know him during our filming process, that he's a very humble, likable man. And you have to kind of pull it out of him, this story.
What also struck me about his story, or what just came up for me watching his story, is this idea of movement, and not just movement of him as a dancer, mm-hmm. but also as an immigrant. He moved around a lot even before coming here to the United States. Can you talk about that? Just that, you know, his experience as an immigrant. You said something, I love what you said. His life was twists and turns.
Yes. And, you know, like many immigrants who come to the United States, their lives were really shaped by history. So I mentioned, you know, he was born in Hong Kong, grew up in Shanghai. His father died while he was young, died in an auto accident. So he and his mother had to find a way to survive in Shanghai. And they did that by, his mother would set him up. He's a young boy, 7, 8 years old, a young boy. He would perform dances in the Shanghai nightclubs. And many of these nightclubs were Russian run because there were many Russian immigrants living in Shanghai during this time period. And so he had to learn the polka and Russian dances and things to satisfy that audience. He would get paid sometimes in rice. I mean, they really struggled. We were talking about being, you know, impoverished, living in Shanghai. And then as the communists started to take over China, they had to escape along with other Russian and Polish and others who were living in Shanghai. They escaped to refugee camp in the Philippines. This was a large camp just for refugees, a tent camp. They thought they were going to be there for a couple months maybe and then relocate, but they ended up staying there for 2 years. And then finally, they were granted permission to immigrate to the United States, and they ended up in Brooklyn. Now, all this time, he was, you know, perfecting his technique. By the time he reaches New York, he's a teenager. He goes to high school, but he is able to get into the School of American Ballet, where he's surprised to learn he's the only Chinese. Only person of color, really.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And many of the instructors there are Russian ballet instructors, and they're shocked at how good he is. They had no idea why does this kid, this Chinese kid, right? Why is he so good? And you know, those are some of the twists and turns that the life in the refugee camp must have been just, you know, amazing. And there are several images that show life in the camp, including we were able to discover pictures of George and his mother with the other refugees. And those, I should point out, those photographs were located. I found them at the Russian Cultural Center in San Francisco.
Really?
Yes. You know, part of the joy of this, doing this film, is the discovery of this story, the twists and turns in his story, right?
Yeah.
So then in New York, in the School of Ballet in 1950s, George Balanchine, the famous, you know, director, is starting to stage a new version of The Nutcracker, you know, the most famous of all ballet performances. And there are these series of dances, right? A Russian dance, an Arab dance, trying to build up this exotic kind of story, right? And he says, I need a Chinese dancer, and George is the only one in the school, so he's going to be it. And he was a huge hit.
And I know it was in The Nutcracker where he would do that big leap. And I love the photo of him just in midair, like legs all stretched out, looking like he was flying.
I mean, he astonished. And those photographs of him doing the leap, those were in Life magazine. He was featured in Life magazine. I mean, astonishing. People really took note of this young kid.
I recall in the film where he was looking for other opportunities and, you know, wanted to be in other shows, and he was turned down because of his height. Did he ever?
That's what they said, right?
Because he was he was so good, but they said it was because of his height.
Let's just be straight. You know, it was discrimination. It was bias. It was racism, right?
What I want to ask you. Did he ever feel that he was hindered in his career because of racism and xenophobia?
In our conversations, he would never say, I was a victim of racism. This is the type of person he was. I think he held that in. But he recognized that the traditions of ballet and the biases of artistic directors and such, that in their minds, you know, male dancers were tall and white. I think astonishing, but maybe it's understandable. He does not speak about this in angry tones. Well, you'll see in the film, these are the cards that I got dealt. And it's more important is, what can I do? How can I show that I'm good?
And he's a blackjack dealer now in Vegas, and he likes it. He likes, I mean, that's such a huge change from being a dancer. But does he enjoy his?
He does. He likes people. He's also very good. He likes being good, right? The people in the casino kind of really like him, and the customers really like him. Because now he's older, I think that he often attracts the older players, often attracts Asian players because he's Asian, et cetera, et cetera. And he likes to chit chat and such.
Does he have any family?
He has no family. When his mother passed away, you know, he had no siblings. He's not married. He has no children. And to our knowledge, well, we don't know about his mother's family.
So where's his community? I thought he's the only child, and I'm an only child, so I thought about that watching the film. So are friends his family? Where's his community that looks after him, takes care of him? He's an elder,
He has some good friends who he spends time with, goes to church with, goes occasionally to celebrate prime rib dinners at some of the restaurants in Las Vegas. But it's a quiet life. I do worry because he is all by himself.
Mm-hmm. There's still to this day not a lot of Asian ballet dancers. Did he ever express any feelings or ideas about him opening doors for other Asian ballet dancers? Or does he even see himself as a trailblazer?
Janae, that's a great question. When we contacted him at the start, and he called back and said, why are you looking for me? I'm a nothing. I'm a nobody. And we tried to explain to him, no, George, we think you're a pioneer. And our motivation, actually, as we started to get into the story, was, we believed he deserved his place, his rightful place in history, in the history of ballet, in the history of Asian Americans. That really didn't strike him. He's so matter of fact. I did what I had to do is one of the things he says in the movie. Now, he does recognize that the Nutcracker and the tea divertisement, which is the part that he performed in, and the Broadway show Flower Drum Song, which was the first kind of all Asian American Broadway musical, very famous, Rodgers and Hammerstein. He understands, he recognizes those were groundbreaking shows and that he played a part in it, and he's very proud of that. But I don't think he would ever say that I am a pioneer. Again, it's that humbleness, that humility that just shines through all the time.
How does he feel now that people are learning of him, his story, after so many years?
He's very proud. He's very excited. We've been able to have him be present at some of the most important screenings. And this will give you an idea of how much respect people have now for him. Our world premiere was at Lincoln Center in New York. And this brought out all of the leaders in the ballet world. He was invited to go to the New York Ballet and not only watch a performance, but to meet all the dancers. We had a talk back after the screening, right? All he had to do was to stand up on and go to the stage, and just people started applauding, just out of respect and recognition for what he had accomplished. And you could see that he was just tickled pink. He was just really loving it.
John, thank you for bringing us this story and covering the story. Thank you so much.
Oh, we're just so grateful, one, that you've given us this opportunity to talk about the story. But
that was film producer and Bay Area journalist John Fudabiki. Stream 10 times better for free on PBS.org or on American Masters YouTube channel. And definitely check it out. It's a really good documentary. Next up, we're going to hit a high note with the music director of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. Keep it locked right here. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton. The music you hear right now is from the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. Their spring concerts are this Friday through Sunday at Hertz Hall on the campus of UC Berklee. All of the shows are free, but you have to RSVP online. And this season, the chorus will perform John of Damascus by composer Sergei Taneyev and Messe de Requiem by Camille Saint-Saëns. And here to tell us more is the musical director of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, Maestro Ming Luke. Hello, Ming.
Hello, how's it going?
Good. You know, I got allergies and they're kicking my behind, but I'm hanging in there.
It certainly is a time of year.
It is. I was like, I think I'm here. I think I'm in the studio. But enough about me, Ming. This is about you. You know, Ming, I don't know if you got a chance to listen, but we just heard an interview about the late ballet dancer George Lee. Did you know about him?
No, I didn't know about him. But, you know, I do so much work in ballet. I was really interested listening as I was waiting for the interview.
Okay, well, yeah, definitely when you get a chance, watch the documentary. You can, and again, you can access it on YouTube. But but interesting that, you know, talking about George Lee, that I read you were a ballet dancer.
Yeah, I did do a lot of dance when I was young. When I was in high school, I was in a typical musicals like a lot of kids are. And, you know, the dance instruction, there was a local school that said, please, we will give you free lessons if you just help partner the girls and learn from them and give them a chance to be partnered. And so I took some dance lessons there. But it's actually what got me into conducting, because mm-hmm. it's the connection between movement and music. It's like when you're conducting, you can feel it. You know, you can feel the vibrations of music. You are literally 2 feet away from musicians. And so you not only are helping shape and make the music, but you're literally feeling it at the same time. And that's what I loved about dance. And of course, that's what got me into conducting.
I love conductors when they're really, when they move a lot too. Are you like that when you conduct? Like just really?
Yeah, they say, especially the dancers, they say, oh, we can tell that you've had dance training before, just the way you move.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. And you saying just feeling that vibration of the music, that's helped you, made you a better conductor, just the connection between dance and feeling the vibration?
Yeah, I think for a conductor, oftentimes your goal is to portray the music so it has clarity for the musicians that you're working with. And in order to connect to the music in that way and to be able to display exactly how the music should be shaped, you know, you do need that physicality and that, for me, that connection to what it feels like and how to shape it.
That's beautiful. I love dance and I love classical music too. So, and just hearing what you're saying puts a smile on my face. You've been a conductor, in Russia, Nashville, San Francisco, Sacramento, New Mexico, so many other places that we don't have time to list. What do you like most about what you do?
You know, when you're visiting different places, every single orchestra is completely different, whether it's in the U.S. or abroad. And, you know, for instance, San Francisco Ballet went to Spain this past October to do Swan Lake in Madrid. Oh. And the Spanish orchestra that we're working with, the orchestra of the theater, they were the stereotype of every single Spanish musician. Every single night they played with such energy and excitement. And it wasn't like, you know, their 90th time of Swan Lake, they get a little tired. No, that every second was fully engaged. And then the shows were at 9 o'clock. Swan Lake is not a short show. And so at midnight, of course, because it's Spain, you know, for all the musicians, it was dinner time. And so it was just a fantastic experience. But, you know, every single orchestra in different places and every single ensemble, they really have they bring something different to it. And so when I was in, Russia and I conducted Bolshoi Orchestra, that was a life transforming experience because they played it in a way that I will never forget. And every country and every ensemble is different. So that's what I love most.
That's beautiful that you get to, even though it's this one genre of music, but you see how it translate just in different cultures and how people perform it in different cultures. You travel a lot too, because I was looking at your 2024-2025 schedule and you were like working with like 13 orchestras in like 1 year around the country. How do you balance all of that?
You know, it's some years the puzzle pieces don't quite fit. You know, an organization will want you for days that overlap with a different organization, and so there'll be more gaps. But this year, for some reason, it all fit together pretty well, which is of course a great thing because you get to work with a lot of different groups. But yeah, the balance was a little bit difficult. You know, there are lots of places that there's some free time and I'll make full use to, you know, in Ottawa, for instance, go mm-hmm. visit the museums or restaurants or just take some time to relax. In Houston, there's these fantastic walkways all around. And so it was great walking around the city. It's so expansive and large. But, you know, I think that it's really just a matter of really finding the time to make sure I can recuperate and then prepare for the next performances.
That's good. That's a good idea that you know, give yourself that time to rest. And you're performing with Berklee, added, you know, to those list of cities, your upcoming show with the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. So I was looking at the works that you're going to be playing and they have stories behind them. Let's talk about them. The Messe des Requiem, and then, you know, say it the proper way because my French is horrible. The Messe des Requiem by Camille Saint-Saëns.
The Requiem Mass. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's an interesting story behind that.
Yeah. It's funny because Camille Saint-Saëns, was this fantastic composer, was considered to be one of the most brilliant and natural, easygoing composers around, like Mozart or Mendelssohn. You know, he had these abilities that just seemed unbelievable to his colleagues. But Saint-Saëns wrote the organ symphony. He wrote many, many works for orchestra, very colorful works. And this Requiem Mass is something that we absolutely love because It was this patron of his that supported Sanson quite a bit. And when he passed away, he left this large sum of money for Sanson. But he said there was one condition, and that was that he had to write a mass, a funeral mass, which is what a requiem is, for him. So Sanson spent the time to write this specific piece, which is has all the drama and color that we normally associate with Sanson, but in a requiem mass.
Yeah, I read it was he left like 100,000 francs or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And I said, that is a friend.
yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny when you look back there, the relationship between patrons and composers are so interesting. For instance, Beethoven, you know, considered to be one of the greatest composers of all time. There was a time where, you know, he wanted to only work for himself. And there is one time where he was a little bit short of money. And so he threatened some of his supporters, hey, I'm going to go work for a royal court unless I get some money. And they all pulled up all this money, so much so that Beethoven would never have to work again. Basically, he could just focus all of his time composing and not trying to, you know, produce and sell things. He would just he'd spend all his time composing. But there are so many stories about patrons and musicians and composers. So Sanson having this incredible large sum of money is a fun story.
I love that Beethoven was like, I don't want a side hustle.
Yeah.
He's like,
Beethoven, we love, because Beethoven was considered to be, we consider amongst musicians, the first gigging musician. Because instead of working for a royal court, he really did everything himself. So he has fantastic, wonderful stories about his personality, but is also his business acumen too. You know, so the premiere of his Fifth Symphony, Sixth Symphony were all in one night, where he had this concert that he produced himself. It's a really he has a lot of fun tales.
And what about this work called John of Damascus? What about that one?
Yeah, Taneyev is a Russian composer. His name is not very well known, even amongst musicians. He was a student of Tchaikovsky at the Moscow Conservatory and was considered also to be a phenomenally brilliant musician. And he was also the teacher of Rachmaninoff. And so we know Tchaikovsky, as was just noted in your previous guest, you know, Tchaikovsky wrote The Nutcracker, mm-hmm. Swan Lake, these fantastic ballets. And of course, Rachmaninoff is renowned for his piano works, his concertos. But Taneyev, who was the student of one and the teacher of the other, is not well known, even though he has phenomenal works. John of Damascus was his first published work. It's Opus Number 1. And it is a beautifully evocative work that has all this Russian character, deep Russian vocal writing. He was famous for fugues, where it's kind of like one voice following another in this and interwoven. And it happens multiple times in this work. And it's really something special to hear in person, because you get to hear all the voices working together, weaving together, and building the story together.
And I'm thinking about going back earlier where you were talking about how, you know, classical music comes up differently for different cultures. So and we're talking about a Russian composer, and he's bringing a different vibe too, to his own music. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with the musical director of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra, Mr. Ming Luke. And you can check out their spring concerts this Friday through Sunday at Hertz Hall on UC Berkeley's campus. The tickets are free, but you must register so you can have your seat. Let's listen to some music that you performed with the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra back in January of this year. Thank you. Ming, what do you remember that song?
Yeah, this is a choral fantasy by Beethoven, in fact.
Ah, Beethoven. So the chorus is 240 people, and then plus you have the orchestra. How do you lead all of those people, Mr. Luke?
Yeah, it's a lot of people. You know, it's so funny because we in fact can't fit on the stage. And at Hertz Hall, we have to rotate amongst who actually sings every single night. So only about 2/3 of the chorus can fit on the stage when we have the full orchestra. And of course, in that last work with piano, if you hear the soloist, that is a work that requires piano solos plus the orchestra plus four solos plus the chorus. It's a lot of people.
Yeah, no, that, oh, wow. Okay, so that's how you have to rotate because there's so many people. But as you, as a leader, like how, I mean, that's your talent, but just you're listening to voices, you're listening to music. I mean, how do you, and then you're conducting and you're doing your own thing on the stage. How are you able just to even take that all in and just lead everyone?
I think that's my favorite part, is that that's what actually really got me to be a conductor. There was this time in freshman year of undergraduate in college, and we went on this tour with this chorus at seven different places. And on the sixth concert, we're singing the same repertoire. And we had some Ukrainian songs, and we happened to be performing at a Ukrainian church. And all of a sudden, all of the Ukrainian members of this church, you realize they recognized what we were singing. And at that moment, it was this incredibly beautiful moment where the entire room was engaged in the music. We as performers, the audience members, it was just a beautiful moment where you can feel the energy. And I realized at that moment that the conductor was the conduit for that. The conductor was the one helping bring everybody together. You know, there's a stereotype that conductors are sort of dictators on the podium, but that's an old school mentality of previous generations. But nowadays, the role of the conductor is really is a collaborator, is to try to get everybody to perform at their best and to help unify the performing ensembles. And so it's really thrilling when you have hundreds of singers, you have dozens of orchestra members, you have soloists, you have piano soloists, you have them all coming together. And the goal is to really unify everybody in the singular piece that you're performing, especially when they're works that aren't as commonly performed. And so I think that's one of my favorite things about being a conductor. I was a pianist growing up. And so piano can be great because you can play by yourself.
And you started at three. And you started at three playing the piano.
Yeah, I started at three. And you can play by yourself. You can play harmony. You can play melody. But that's also the lonely thing, too, is oftentimes, you know, there's not as many opportunities to perform with people. And to be a conductor, it basically means I get to collaborate with all these incredibly talented musicians. And that's very thrilling for me.
Okay, so we have about 30 seconds left. So what can people expect from the concerts this weekend?
I think my favorite thing about Hertz Hall is that you're really close to the performers. They are really just feet away from the front row, and it is a thrilling set of pieces that we're going to be performing. There's also an orchestral work, the Adagietto from Mahler's Fifth Symphony for strings and harp. But our goal is that music should be accessible for everybody, not only the performers, but concerts are free. And hopefully there are still room for tickets. So if you're interested, please check it out and reserve your ticket.
All right. Maestro Ming Luke, thank you so much. It was nice chatting with you.
And thank you for having me.
Ming Luke is the musical director of the Berklee Community Chorus and Orchestra. You can see the chorus perform and orchestra this Friday through Sunday at Hertz Hall on the campus of UC Berklee. And we'll have a link on our website where to RSVP online for free reserve tickets. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with me, the congested Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner. Thank you, Damian, to clear my throat. And our director of programming, David Boyer. I'm out of it today. And thank you all for tuning in. This weekend is the Bay Area Book Festival, so make sure you go to that this weekend. For Prince fans listening, next Thursday, June 5th, I'll be part of a poetry reading about the late singer. And you can join us at Pegasus Books at 7 p.m. The event is a part of the Berklee Poetry Festival. And May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And I know there's a lot going on in the country and the world right now. So treat yourself to something beautiful. Go out in nature, read a book, go to the museum, go to a show, get together with some friends. That's what I did last weekend. I got together with some Black women and we just sang spirituals and uplifting songs. Art can be healing. And thank you, Jamie, for the mouth drop. That's what I was trying to say. The cough drop. I told you I'm out of it. All right. I'm going to go home and lay down in my moo moo with some tea. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.